Buddhist Summer School, Sunday morning, 3rd September 1978. And those of you who were present here last year will remember that our theme was the Aryan silence, based upon the Buddha's specific teachings to his bhikkhus when they were assembled in concourse, as it was called, to let their conversation, if any, be upon the Dhamma only. If not, observe the Aryan silence. I'd like to read you just a very short paragraph out of this book, The Opening of the Wisdom Eye, by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. On page 46, writing about refraining from foolish chatter, he says, "Foolish chatter is of three sorts: untrue nonsense, such as prayers to gods, legends, religious myths, and miraculous tales. Second, worldly nonsense includes gossip, useless stories, fiction, and jokes. While true nonsense is the teaching of Dharma to a person who is not yet ready to receive it." A paragraph most worthwhile studying carefully. The Buddha referred to the ordinary man of the world, the worldling, who lived according to the world's standards and values and so forth, called them the putujjanas. That's the ordinary name for worldling, putujjana. And he pointed out that the putujjana who wished to grow towards his true fulfillment, to free himself from dukkha, was aiming towards becoming the Uttara Puriso, sometimes called the Uttama Puriso or the Mahapuriso. He uses all three terms. Now, the Putujjana deals with restricted energies, the ordinary energies that we know of and man has known throughout the centuries. In our modern day and age, we principally use electrical energy, chemical energy, and so on. They used ordinary firewood and charcoal, mechanical energies for all their daily purposes and so forth. Now, the Uttara Purisho deals with archetypal energies primarily, in addition, of course, to the ordinary mechanical energies which we have to use for our daily routine in everyday life. Now, these archetypal energies are the main ways in which the one transcendent creative energy, in constant creative action, manifests itself, and the form in which it works through us. The archetypal energies are manifold. Only some of them will function through human beings, because all the different creations of nature are built in such a manner that they are receptacles, fit apparatus for allowing certain archetypal energies to function through them. And these archetypal energies, as I have mentioned on previous occasions, are known by the names of the archangels and angels, the asuras and the suras, the devas and the amishaspans, and so on, through the various great religions of the world. These are the different main forms in which the primordial creative energy manifests itself through us on the universal and transcendental scale, insofar as any one of us has developed sufficiently far, then through us this, that, and all the other type of archetypal energy functions through us. Now the Uttara Purusha is the one who can deal with these consciously, knowingly. This is the tremendous influence of the perfected holy ones. To give you a simple example from the Old Testament, for instance, you have names like Michael, Michael means he who is like God. The name John means the beloved of God. Gabriel, Uriel, and all the different archangelic forms, they all have their specific meanings. It's the same in the Zarathustrian pantheon and so forth. But primarily, you will find wisdom, love, truth, beauty, holiness or wholeness, immortality, and creative power itself emphasized. For instance, in the Zarathustrian teaching, we have Vahu Mano, which is the pure mind, the mind of God, as it is said. We have Kshatra, which is the power of God, Haurvatat, which stands for holiness, wholeness, Amiratatat, which stands for immortality, Asha, which stands for righteousness, truth, the doctrine, the Dhamma, as we would say, and so forth. You see, so through all the religions, we have these different names given. And in Buddhistic terms, we have as an outstanding example, the names of the Dhyani Buddhas, as they are called. The Dhyani Buddhas in Mahayana. Now it must be clearly understood that all these are potentialities within us ourselves. We mustn't look upon these names as belonging to particular individual entities existing in an immaterial state. It's very important to realize this. When people who are mystics, who are visionaries, say that they saw the Dhyani Buddha Vairochana or Amoghasiddhi or something like that, or someone like that, you see, it really means that their state of awareness, their sensitivity was such at that time that the impression on the brain was so intense that it is impossible to distinguish between actually seeing with the physical eyes and being aware, intensely, fully aware of a presence of an energy with your mental eye, with the third eye, so to say. But you don't see things. The brain afterwards interprets in terms of shapes and forms. That's the brain's work, because the brain is confined to the consciousnesses of sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, and the image-making faculty, the imaginative faculty. So you see, it's very easy to get muddled up and mixed up over all these things. But they are real energies. That is what we have to remember, these archetypal forms. Now, in us ourselves, you know the usual Buddhist analysis of the five khandas, or skandhas to use the Sanskrit term. Rupa, form, shape, Vedana, sensation, feeling, Sanya, perception, Sankhara, the mental volitions, and Vijnana, discriminative consciousness, generally speaking. Although in Buddhism too, Vijnana is used as in the Brahmanical teachings, meaning full consciousness in its profounder sense, not merely in its function as discriminative consciousness. These five skandhas of the Buddhist analysis, as they are at present constituting us, are imperfect. We may use the word impure if you like, provided we do not regard the word impure from a purely moralistic point of view. The moral aspect is there, but that's one aspect. Impure meaning generally imperfect. And the five khandhas which compose us become the five knowledges, the five jnanas of the Uttara Purusha. Now, we touched upon this point yesterday, but it is well worth repeating. In fact, it can never be repeated too often. When we ask a person or look into ourselves and inquire why we turn to religion, if we can be truly clear-sighted in our investigation and perfectly honest with ourselves, we will always find that the reason is one which is concerned fundamentally with oneself. I was in suffering. I was perplexed. I wanted to find out this, that, or the other. I wanted. That is the root of it all. But the thing we must remember is this, that religion, in its purity, in its reality, is not concerned, not at all concerned, with ego-circumscribed desire gratification. If we may use the word desire at all, we may say that religion is concerned with the fulfillment of the desire, the chanda, the passion, passion in the great sense, in the profound sense, which urges a man towards letting himself become the pure vessel of transcendence itself, of the totality. That is the one passion, the one desire, if you like to use the word desire, with which religion is concerned. But every other form of desire which is circumscribed to oneself is not the concern of religion. If we do not truly realize this, and therefore if we as individuals seek our satisfaction, our own satisfaction or salvation, material or spiritual, then we are impure. Our work during this whole week will be tainted as long as that is present. It must be an absolutely pure aspiration, meaning our awareness of that urge from within us, to use a theistic phrase, of the working of the immanent God in us. Our awareness of that is the one thing which must be the driving force with all our work, all our effort. Then our effort is perfect effort. Samavayamo. Otherwise, we will remain worldlings, putujjanas, mere worldlings, concerned with ourselves, our salvation, our place on the right hand side, or if you prefer, the left hand side of the Lord in the heavens. Now, how is our body brought to maturity? The physical body, as you know, matures shortly after puberty in adulthood, young adulthood, and so on. What is it that brings the body to maturity? Is it our desire, our wishful thinking? Or is it our preconceptions about what the body ought to be, our own body ought to be, or what we would like it to be? Not the least bit. There is this mysterious power, life, life energy, which brings each body to fulfillment, to maturity, I mean. You see? And we can't order it. Now, I'm mentioning this because this is a very great contrast to the maturing of the psyche, the purification and maturing of the psyche. The life force brings the body to maturity. Life force, or if you like, nature, brings the body to maturity. The maturing of the psyche is our personal responsibility. This is where we play our part, so to say. We mean something to the world by the word world, meaning first and foremost our own psychophysical organism, and secondarily, our environment and all that the environment contains. It is our personal responsibility. This is where we have to play our part, as we say. Now, there is a power within us. We have already talked about it a bit. There is that power within us, immanent, dormant, which is the essence of transcendent creative energy itself, which is creative energy, that power is the power that enables us to fulfill, to recognize and fulfill our personal responsibility. And our work consists in essentially in the purification of the psyche. Purification by constant mindfulness and awareness of what we actually are as manifested from moment to moment in terms of our thoughts and feelings, our words and our actions. The Buddha uses this word over and over again. Circumspect. Be very circumspect all the time. Seeing peril in the slightest manifestation of tanha, Trishna in the Sanskrit, whose first meaning is thirst for sentient existence, sensational existence. Be very circumspect and see peril in every desire that arises, because all the desires that arise are born of self-concern. That is why all our desires are different from each other. We constituted as we are, have our own particular desires. Of course, one can classify desires in a very general way, as they arise in mankind as a whole. The desire for this, that and the other, happiness, security, love, success, a few such divisions can be made. But in every single individual, the form, the particular form, the particular shape that desire expresses itself is different. That is individual to each one of us. So watch that carefully all the time. So, the awakening of our hidden sense of transcendence, our hidden immanence, the awakening of that is the concern of religion. How to let the first thought of enlightenment, as it is called, I prefer the sense of enlightenment, the awareness of enlightenment to the thought. I prefer that word, those words to thought. Let that thought of enlightenment arise, and this hidden power within us, the divine power, works towards helping us to bring it to fulfillment, so that it becomes a pure flame of aspiration, a flame of aspiration in which there is no selfness. It's only the fulfillment of the total cosmic process which is important. And it is that totality, that cosmic process, and the great urge underlying it, which is the thing that comes to fruition in us when all that obstructs that urge inside us because of our imperfection is understood, transmuted. The five khandhas become the five Dhyani Buddhas. Now, it is important to understand something of the Buddhist philosophy underlying its approach to mind and matter. The different religions of the world all have an implied metaphysics, although none of the religious teachers the great religious teachers ever produced a system of metaphysics. They never wrote treatises on philosophy at all. None of them. They were concerned with the practical aspect, living, so to live that the purpose of the cosmos will be fulfilled. But they wouldn't discuss the purpose of the cosmos as such. But it was impossible to avoid suggesting that purpose in the actual ethical and practical teachings which they gave. Because obviously anybody with intelligence could infer logically what that purpose could be. Now, one day at Nalanda, the Buddha was in Pavarika's mango grove. And a householder in the town of Nalanda, remember this Nalanda is the Nalanda which almost 700 years after the Buddha's death in the 4th century AD became the famous University of Nalanda, the greatest Buddhist university of India. A householder by the name of Kevada came to the Buddha in the mango grove and asked the Buddha, or rather suggested to the Buddha, that it would be wonderful if he would show some mystic wonders to the folk who lived in Nalanda, because then they would be impressed and feel that, here is indeed one of the supreme teachers. And the Buddha declines to do that. And he tells Kevada certain other things. One of them included the wonder, the mystic wonder of true education, of right education. And in expanding that, he told Kevada of one of his own bhikkhus who, in profound meditation, inquired of all the devas in the deep states of consciousness a question regarding the four great elements of which the whole manifested world was made. Their elements, unlike our chemical elements, were, of course, as you all know, earth, water, fire, air. You see? And the question which this monk asked was this: where now do these four great elements, earth, water, fire, and air, pass away, leaving no trace behind? Note that question carefully. This monk asks the question of all the inhabitants of the immaterial spheres. These are all personifications, of course, you see, the inhabitants of the immaterial spheres. He asks the question of all these, and he goes from grade to grade. And you know, in Buddhism, we have the same sort of gradation, you know, of the lesser angels, the greater angels, the greater devas, the still greater devas, and so on. There's a wonderful big list. But it is very instructive, that list. And the head of each of these groups says, I don't know. I don't know. You better ask the chop man there. And he says the same thing. I don't know. You better ask the fellow who is above my head. And so on, you see. And they go ultimately right up to the great Brahma himself. And he says, you know, really, I am the great Brahma, the absolute, the all, the Lord of heaven and earth and all things therein and so forth. But I don't know, to tell you the truth. Why don't you go and ask the enlightened one, you see, the perfected holy one? Perhaps he may be able to tell you. So, of course, he comes to the Buddha and asks the question. And the Buddha alters the form of the question. Now this is very important. Instead of asking, where do these great elements pass away, leaving no trace behind? The Buddha says, ask this question, where do earth, water, fire, air, no footing find? Where do they originate at all? And where is it that they do not have an origin? Therefore, you see, this is extraordinarily penetrating. And the Buddha himself gives the answer. That famous phrase, vijnanam anidassanam anantam sabbato bhavam. They find no footing in the invisible, infinite, all radiant vijnana, the supreme awareness. He's using the term vijnana in the supreme sense, not in its sense of discriminative consciousness. That's the way you should ask the question. Now, the term anidassanam alludes to the fact that consciousness, I'll use the term consciousness without meaning discriminative consciousness, but the absolute consciousness. Buddhism does not use the term Atma and misrepresents the original Brahmanical meaning of Atma. I don't know why, but it does. But that is what this phrase actually means. So I'll use the term consciousness. Anidassanam alludes to the fact that consciousness, when differentiated or objectivized, steps into visible appearance, materializes, as we may say, as our body, which in reality is the result of previous form-creating states of consciousness. Vijnanam anidassanam, therefore, can only be understood as consciousness in its undivided purity, not yet and no more split into the duality of subject and object, the duality of nama rupa. Buddha Ghosha, in his Visuddhimagga, declares this consciousness to be identical with nirvana. Sabbato pabham, everywhere shining. All radiant. Sabbato pabham emphasizes the purity, the utter purity of this consciousness. And this is the consciousness in the state of enlightenment. There's a very remarkable sutta in the first volume of the Majjhima where the Buddha talks of himself as abiding constantly in the first fruits of the state of sunyata phala samadhi. The samadhi which is the fruit of the realization of the Shunyata, the utter emptiness in relationship to the entire manifested world. No limitation in which I ever constantly abide. That's about the only place where I have come across that statement made by the Buddha about his, about himself. Again, we have the statement in the Udana, which you all know, there is the unborn, unoriginated, etc. And that too alludes to this state. Now note very carefully, this consciousness in its absolutely original state becomes the fivefold differentiation which constitutes each of us individuals. Fivefold differentiation. Vedana, sannyasa, sankhara, vijnana, we all understand, stands for the psychical, mental aspect of us. But rupa, we usually understand as a material form, just the physical body itself. Now this is a mistake which it is very easy to make. Rupa is not merely physical form, matter, substance. The material aspect, the substantial aspect, is part of the whole aspect of rupa. Rupa simply means shape or form. Now, all our feelings, all our thoughts, all our states of mind, etc., are all different shapes taken by what we commonly regard as the mental aspect. So in Buddhist philosophy, the entire thing is essentially mental in nature. There is no sharp distinction between body, material, and feelings, thoughts, etc., as mental, as immaterial. It's not very easy. I myself found it quite difficult to keep this in mind. It took me years and years before one is able to sort of take it as a matter of course. That this is not matter as something separate from mind, but is mind itself. The most concrete aspect, the concrete manifestation of mind. You see? It's very important to understand this. There are philosophers and intellectuals who will say, oh yes, Bishop Berkeley talked about all this and so forth, you see, in his modern philosophy. Yes, up to a point, but only up to a very small point. If Bishop Berkeley had the good fortune to have known the Buddhist philosophy or any of the profound philosophies of India and China, perhaps he would have produced something even better than he actually produced. Now, since consciousness cannot be dissociated from mind, we can appreciate why mind holds a place of prime importance with the Buddha and in the whole of Buddhist teaching. The Dhammapada, the very first verse, states, all things are preceded by, led by, and created by the mind. This is one of the great utterances of the Buddha himself. And the Buddha, therefore, rejected the concept of substance. You know, people say that it is out of matter that ultimately, when molecules began to get together and form rudimentary forms of life, say like the Coelenterata and various other such forms, they developed the faculty of delaying a response to an outer stimulus, which meant that from within there was a process, a withinness was in manifestation. This has been known to the scientific world well before the beginning of this century, you see. And therefore they said these are the beginnings which ended up where man is concerned with the nerves and the brain and conscious process which goes on within us and attempts to control and mold the environment and so forth. But the Buddha rejected that concept of substance. He never answered, he never concerned himself with the question, with the philosophical question of the objectivity of the manifested universe. He saw that the essential thing was mind and its manifestations, and this itself was, the body itself was the product of the mind. So therefore, the physical is not a contrast to the psychical, and the physical functions are not over against psychical functions. Material and psychical are merely an outer and inner appearance of one and the same process. Now you see, if we grasp this, we will probably find ourselves very much healthier. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, Descartes. But perhaps not quite so sound as this way of approaching the whole thing. See, Descartes was responsible for this very fixed dualism which sprang up after his day. Descartes, followed by Malebranche and later on by the English school of physiocrats. John Locke was responsible for very unfortunate presentations in his philosophy, developed partly by David Hume and John Stuart Mill and all the others. All the conflict which has arisen as a result of taking it for granted that body and mind are two different entities would have been avoided if such a philosophy didn't catch hold of the imagination of the Western world. But previous to that, it was different. Through the Middle Ages and going right back to the times of Aristotle, the philosophies which arose in the in Europe, the Christian Europe particularly, were much more holistic too. Now, there is this other statement. Within this very body, the Buddha declares, mortal though it be and only a fathom high, but conscious and endowed with mind is the world, the whole world, and the waxing and waning thereof, and the way that leads to the passing thereof. It's a very, very profound statement. Doesn't seem profound at a first glance, but if we really let the mind dwell quietly upon those words, quietly, because then the words which do represent truth, those words will speak to you, flood your understanding, your inner vision with something at least of the nature of the reality of our own psychophysical organism and what it means. Because of this, the Buddhist does not inquire into the essence of matter, but only into the essence of the sense perceptions and experiences which raise up in us the idea of matter. If we had no sensations, no feelings, no mental processes, as we call them, going on, we would have no idea of matter. Matter is an idea, and we posit against that the term immaterial as non-matter. That leaves the psyche in a state of continual conflict, continual disharmony. Rupa should not be rendered by matter or the principle of materiality. Although the word materiality, or better still, corporeality as it applies to us, is helpful. If nama rupa is understood as mentality corporeality, we will get, we will be a little more free of this sense of duality within us about mind and matter regarding ourselves. It is the universal mentality, the universal corporeality, which manifests in each individual as that particular nama rupa. Rupa should be rendered rather as the sensuous, not sensual, the sensuous which includes all the senses in action, therefore, which includes the concept of matter from a psychological point of view, without establishing a dualistic principle in which matter becomes the absolute opposite of mind, nama. Rupa literally means form or shape, mental or immaterial. That is, I beg your pardon, material or immaterial. That is, concrete or imagined, apprehended by the senses or conceived by the mind, the brain, essentially. The concept rupa is much wider than the concept matter. Thus, in the great Tibetan phrase, Om Mani Padme Hum, Mani, the jewel, is loosely translated as, oh, the jewel in the lotus. Mani, the jewel, refers to the mind and mind alone. Recognizing that the multifarious forms of appearance are mind-made, this radiant jewel, the mani, is the mind alone from which all things borrow their temporal reality. The jewel became, in early Buddhism, the symbol of the three vessels of enlightenment: the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. The jewel is the three ratna, the threefold jewel of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And it is particularly emphasized that the true meaning of Sangha is not just members of a society, of a religious society in this case, but it stands for those who had realized the Dhamma and actually lived the holy life. This was the real meaning of the Sangha. This, of course, was also the original meaning of when Christianity rose up, of the body of the church. The church really meant the collection of those who had realized completely the teaching of the Holy One. In later Buddhism, the idea of the jewel took the form of the vajra. Now, vajra in Buddhism is different from vajra in Brahmanism. The vajra means, in the first place, thunderbolt. And it was the symbol of Indra, the chief of the Rigvedic pantheon, Indra. He was the thunderbolt wielder, like Zeus of the Greek pantheon. But in later Buddhism, the vajra took the form of the scepter, the diamond scepter. So the status of the vajra was changed from meaning a thunderbolt into meaning spiritual supremacy by becoming an attribute of the enlightened one. In Buddhist tradition, vajra is always compared to the diamond. In one of the most profound philosophical scriptures of the Mahayana, we find this at the end. This Vajra Chedika Prajna Paramita Sutra, which is a sacred exposition, is known as such because it is hard and sharp like a diamond, cutting off all arbitrary conceptions and leading to the other shore of enlightenment. All our concepts, all our theses and their antitheses, to all of them we have to answer both yes and no, because they are all arbitrary conceptions which spring out of the dualistic functioning of consciousness because of the absence of complete wholeness or holiness within ourselves. And so all those concepts, all those conceptual formulations and their corresponding verbal formulations have the tendency to mislead us. They do up to a point suggest the truth. Just as a photograph, a still photograph, is something from which you could recognize the living person if you saw him. See, so only up to that extent are our arbitrary conceptions of any use at all. Otherwise, where the supreme reality is concerned, where nirvana is concerned, where the total release out of the limitations of dukkha is concerned, they are all misleading. The Buddha himself says this in some of his discourses, that whatsoever we say about the deep states of consciousness, about enlightenment itself and the state of nirvana and so forth. That's why he wouldn't argue about nirvana, you see. Whatever we say about it, because it is a put together, a sankata, a put together by our thought process, which is an analytical splitting up the wholeness process, is not so. Exactly as in the original, in the oldest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, Yajnavalkya, that supreme teacher of the Upanishadic tradition, declared neti, neti, neti with respect to the Atma or Brahman. Those schools of Buddhism which placed this teaching in the center of their life and thought are therefore known under the collective term of the Vajrayana. And this Vajra, the Tibetan word is Dorje, is the symbol. The central idea of the Vajra, the diamond scepter, consists in the purity, the radiance, and the indestructibility of the enlightenment consciousness, the Bodhicitta. That is to say, the Bodhicitta come to fruition through us. At its inception, it is just this transcendent aspiration, the one and only right aspiration. Samā saṅkapo, samādhiṭṭhi, perfect understanding, samā saṅkapo, perfect aspiration. This is the perfect aspiration. As a symbol, the Vajra takes the shape of the diamond scepter. Its center is an empty sphere to represent the seed of the universe in its undifferentiated state, the primordial state, which the Greeks named chaos, but chaos for us through the centuries has come to mean disorder, not that state which I tried to suggest by using the phrase vibrant quiescence, the state of vibrant quiescence. That is the original meaning of chaos. Disorder is the secondary meaning. Out of that vibrant quiescence emerged the whole cosmic order. In its undifferentiated state, and in Brahmanical teaching, the word is bindu. In Buddhism, we have the word shunya, shunyata, and so forth. Its spatial unfoldment, its unfoldment in terms of space, time, matter, causation, and so forth, corresponds to the spiritual differentiation, note, the spiritual differentiation of the principle of enlightenment into the five transformed constituents of consciousness. In us, rupa, vedna, sanya, sankhara, vijnana, and in terms of their perfection, when they have become the pure knowledges of the archetypal energies, of which these are the representatives, they are completely spiritualized. And then they are represented by the term Dhyani Buddha. Now, the term Dhyani Buddha is a term coined by Western scholars in order to distinguish the spiritual or symbolical figures of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas visualized in meditation, Dhyana, in meditation, from the historical Buddha, who is always referred to as Shakyamuni.